This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Julia Alvarez, was born into a prosperous, privileged family in the Dominican Republic. But when she was 10, Julia emigrated with her family to the United States and became a minority, a New York Hispanic. She and her three sisters became teenagers American style, swept up in the rebelliousness and sexual openness of the late 60s. It was all pretty shocking to their parents, who left the Dominican Republic to get away from the dictator Trujillo. Alvarez has written a semi-autobiographical novel about four sisters from the Dominican Republic who come of age in the States. It's called How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. Alvarez lives in Vermont now, where she teaches at Middlebury College. Before we talk about Alvarez's life, here's a reading from How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents.
This is from Daughter of Invention, and it's one of the stories about Yo-Yo, the third oldest, who becomes a writer, and she is asked to give the Teacher's Day address at school, and she can't think of what kind of a speech to write. And finally, she reads some Whitman, and she gets very inspired. She reads the lines, especially, "I celebrate myself and sing myself. The best student learns to destroy the teacher." And so she writes the speech that's a little bit off the beaten track. I mean, she's not being as grateful to teachers as she should. So she reads this to her parents in the bedroom and waits to be praised. And, of course, her father hears the speech, and he doesn't like it at all. And his name is Carlos in the passage that I'm going to read. So he hears the speech, and he says, "What is wrong with her speech?" Carlos wagged his head at her. His anger was always more frightening in his broken English, as if he had mutilated the language in his fury, and now there was nothing to stand between them and his raw, dumb anger. "What is wrong? I will tell you what is wrong. It shows no gratitude. It is boastful. I celebrate myself. The best student learns to destroy the teacher," he mocked Yo-Yo's plagiarized words. "That is insubordinate. It is improper. It is disrespecting of her teachers." In his anger, he had forgotten his fear of lurking spies. Each wrong he voiced was a decibel higher than the last outrage. Finally, he shouted at Yo-Yo, "As your father, I forbid you to make that a speech." He leapt from the bed, throwing off his covers. The Spanish newspapers flew across the room. He snatched the speech out of Yo-Yo's hands, held it before the girl's wide eyes, a vengeful, mad look in his own, and then once, twice, three, four, countless times, he tore the speech into shreds. Probably, if Yo-Yo had thought a moment about it, she would not have done what she did next. She would have realized her father had lost brothers and friends to the dictator Trujillo. For the rest of his life, he would be haunted by blood in the streets and late-night disappearances. Even after all these years, he cringed if a black Volkswagen passed him on the street. He feared anyone in uniform, the meter maid giving out parking tickets, a museum guard approaching to tell him not to get too close to his favorite Goya. Yo-Yo gathered a handful of scraps, stood up, and hurled them in his face. In a low, ugly whisper, she pronounced Trujillo's hated nickname, "Chapita. You're just another Chapita."
Julia Alvarez, did anything like this ever happen to you, that you wrote something and read it to your father, and he had this really surprising reaction?
Well, it's funny because I make up so much in terms of the fictional characters that sometimes I lose a sense of what is made up and what really happened. I do remember a speech that my father forbid me to give because it was kind of, it was sort of the first speech, as I say in this story, in which I found myself in English, in which I sounded like myself in English. And it was kind of spunky and not really sort of the conventional little praising of teacher speech. And I remember that he forbid me to give that speech at school. But it didn't evolve the way that this story evolves. Because, of course, I wanted to push it further in the story and find out what happens when you hurl these two worlds together, the new American world that Yo-Yo is entering, and the old world and the police state and the terror that the father still lives in. Yeah.
Were you ever embarrassed by them, by their opinions, by their clothes, by their language when you were young?
Well, I think when, you know, when you're a teenager and you're embarrassed by yourself, your whole body feels like it's the wrong size and the wrong everything. I was embarrassed by the fact that that my friends wouldn't understand my father when he spoke because he had a heavy accent, that we talked too loud. I remember we lived in a building in New York City and they complained that our food smelled. And I felt this, you know, I had been the way we were. Back in the Dominican Republic, we were just like everybody else, and all of a sudden, the sense that there's something different about us, and I didn't have the good luck of living in a comunidad where there were other Dominicans, and I could say, "Hey, you know, this is the way we are." I thought maybe something is wrong with us.
Yeah, well, you're in the position of having gone from being in your country to suddenly being what we call a minority, and that you must have felt that difference.
Well, it was, I mean, it's strange because as you know from the book, part of what I'm writing about is coming from the old country, being from a sort of well-to-do family, being part of the majority, and all of a sudden thrust into a world where you are the minority, where you don't really belong, and you feel at odds with what's going on. And I think that's the experience that drove me to be a writer. I always say that I would never have been a writer in Spanish. What made me a writer? I'm not a born writer. You know, I wasn't born wanting to be a writer or having that desire for you know, the solitude and the interior life of a writer. But coming to this country, and all of a sudden losing a culture, a homeland, a language, a family. It's sort of, I wanted a portable homeland. And that's what the imagination, the world of the imagination is. So I think in a way, becoming a so-called minority is what really drove me to language and to words and to the imagination.
Do you think having come from a prosperous family,
right,
that you had a different sense of being a, quote, minority than people who grew up as a, quote, minority in the United States, where they'd never experienced being part of the majority, where they'd never experienced being privileged?
Well, I think in some ways, it was also, becoming a minority was also good for me because I developed a social conscience. I think it was there growing up because you can't live in a third world country, a so-called third world country, and see the difference between those who have and those who don't have, and not be somehow affected by it and not want to do something about it. But maybe you grow unconscious about it if you live there, you know, for the rest of your life or whatever. But I think coming to this country gave me a social conscience in a way that I wouldn't have had before because I saw what it meant to be on the other side, you know. And I also, I mean, reading books and going to school and going to, you know, being in the in college during the 60s, I mean, you develop a social conscience then too. So I think it really, you know, it was a mixed and bittersweet experience to be an immigrant in this country.
Why did your family leave the Dominican Republic?
Why did they leave? Well, it was, of course, in the book, it's exaggerated, but it was because of political reasons. We had a dictatorship for 31 years, Trujillo, whose nickname was Chapita. And
what does Chapita mean?
I don't know what it means. I think probably some Dominicanos out there know what it means. It's one of those, hated nicknames that he had. And, you know, I'm not quite sure what it means, but that's how you referred to him. And We were living in the Dominican Republic, and my father was involved in the underground against Trujillo. And so we were lucky that we got out, before something happened, before he got arrested or killed.
Growing up, were you afraid of the secret police? And did you carry that fear with you when you came to the United States?
It's funny because, you know, now I look back and I talk this over with my sisters. Did we know things? You know, because of course my parents never spoke. And I remember different incidents, which then didn't quite make sense. There was just an atmosphere of cautiousness. I remember that I had a pen pal in the United States, and my parents were very afraid because, of course, the mail was all read and censored about what I would write. And my mother insisted that she read the letters before I wrote to this pen pal in the United States. And, you know, my English was, dear, whatever, dear Sarah, how are you? I am fine. Goodbye. You know, that was it. But she was afraid that I would say something. And so little things like that, that now I say, aha, I see what was going on. I remember my parents looking out the windows and saying, are they there? Are they there? Because it turned out later that for a period, my father was under a kind of surveillance, and the black Volkswagens would come up the driveway. And I said, who are there? And something was told to me, oh, guests that are coming, or your tía is coming over. So I didn't know. But now I say, aha, that's what was going on. But I'm sure we all lived with a sense of, you know, sort of subliminal anxiety, because the grown-ups were terrified.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Julia Alvarez, and her new novel is called How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Julia Alvarez is my guest. When you moved to the States, did a lot of the girls your age have no idea what or where the Dominican Republic was?
Absolutely. I remember that they would call it Dominique or down there, and all kinds of questions about, you know, do you eat stuff like this there? You know, there were ignorant questions, but they were, some of them were well-meaning questions, curiosity, because I was the only immigrant in my class that was not, I didn't come with a wave of immigrants. There weren't a lot of other Dominicanas or even Puerto Ricanas or anybody in the class but myself, and in the other classes, my sisters. So there was curiosity, and there was a little bit of ostracism, or, you know, hard times because we were different and we didn't know the language, we didn't dress like everyone else, and we had accents.
When you got to college, did it almost become, hip in a way to be Latina? You know, because there were revolutionary movements in Latin America, and you were genuinely from a third world background. You know what I mean?
Exactly. That was very strange to all of a sudden, for it to be popular to be who I was. And, I just remember even the look. You know, I don't know if you remember late 60s, 70s, the peasant blouses, the hoop earrings, the clothes from Mexico, the sarapes and so forth. And all of a sudden, there were people trying to look like us. And that was a strange experience, to suddenly be popular for being, for what had been at first the source of name-calling and ostracism and so forth, to suddenly be a popular thing to be. And it gives you a sense of perspective, too, about image building and so forth. You really do have to carry who you are inside you, and not depend on it out there necessarily from the mainstream culture to define you.
I'm wondering if in the late 60s, some people who you'd meet in college, for instance, would say, when they met you, would just assume that you were an authentic expression of the oppressed poor of the third world, and they'd be disappointed to find that you were actually from early privileged background.
I know that's, again, you know, the image building, you know, that just the stereotyping. If you are, you know, from a third world country, then you are, you're an oppressed minority. And I felt almost as though I was getting credit for something that I wasn't. And I had to sort of re-educate people about myself. And also, in some ways, it also made me feel guilty about my own privileges, because I felt that, gosh, you know, I didn't feel like the right kind of Latina, you know, that happened. And it's still, you know, coming from a privileged background, coming from a family that could give me things, it's still a burden. I mean, it really, especially now as I get older, I see it as a real responsibility. I mean, I'm still hunting in my own head what it is that I want to do to give back some of the privileges that I had.
One of the things one of the characters has to deal with in your novel is certain differences, certain kind of sexist habits of the father. For instance, when this sister gives birth to a son, and it's the first son in a couple of generations,
right.
She already has a daughter, right? But, her father comes, and he's so thrilled to have a grandson, and he's whispering to the grandson about how he can be president because he's an American citizen, and this son's really going to grow up and be something. And the mother of the son is standing there thinking, well, he never said this to my daughter. My daughter's standing right here. My daughter's hearing this. And, she's very upset at the way her father's playing favorites.
Right, right.
With his grandson over his granddaughter. Have you had to deal with things like that? You know, things that you would now interpret as sexist that seem perfectly acceptable in the culture that you're from?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think part of the reason that America was, North America coming to the United States was liberated me in some ways into thinking that as a woman I could do things which I don't think I would have thought I could do, especially from my background and in my family. Women just didn't do those things. But at the same time, because my father, not my fictional father, but my real father, didn't have any sons, each one of us, of his daughters, at one point or another became his son, quote-unquote, his son. And so, in a way, a kind of sexism that might have happened if there were a son, a real son in the family, didn't happen because we were just daughters.
Was there a turning point in your life where you felt that you needed to stand up to your father's authority because there were things he believed that you didn't believe, or there was a way you wanted to live your life that went counter to what he wished for you, and you had to stand up for what you believed in no matter how much it would hurt him?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that one of the things that made it easier for me, I was the one that was the writer, the bohemian, so in a way it gave me a certain amount of license. I think actually writing is one of the ways that has been hard for me in terms of, my parents understanding that I'm a writer and that I have these stories to tell. And that sometimes they're not the stories that they would want for me to tell.
Oh, sure.
You know, that's been for me a way that to stand up and say, I have these stories to tell. I have to be true to my experience. Sometimes they'll say, but why do you have to publish that? You know, why do you have to? People will think that that it's about us, or people will say certain things, and that has been what's been hard for me to claim, and it's something that I've talked to other writers about, and particularly other writers, ethnic writers. You know, you think of Maxine Hong Kingston, how Woman Warrior begins. My mother told me never ever to repeat the story, and the story starts. You know, this mandate of silence, of we keep things among ourselves. We don't go out there and. And, like those Americans, they get on talk shows and tell everybody their stuff. You know, and the thing that you have to explain is that it is fiction, that you're not trying to, tell family secrets or whatever, that you're making things up. And that if people think it's about your family, you just have to say, they're made up. You know, the configurations are very similar, but they're made up things. They're lies, as my mother would say. You know, you lie to tell the truth as a writer.
That impulse to not tell in your family probably has a lot to do with the secret police and fear of like things getting out. And also with the fear of being thought of as being different because you're in a culture where everybody's different from you are.
Right, right. I mean, the excerpt that we read at the beginning of the program where Yo-Yo experiences censorship from her father. I mean, at the end of the story, the father and she have reconcile. And the father says, your father, he just want to protect you. And there's that impulse of, don't tell the secrets because the secret police are outside the door and ready to nab you. And even though you know that it's not true, there's that sense of secrecy, of having to be careful what you say, of looking over your shoulder. So I think that persists, that kind of censorship. And also, yes, the censorship of being in another culture, in another world. And, you know, you keep your things to yourself. Entre familia. You don't go out there and yak to here I am yakking at strangers, you know. And so it for them to understand that I'm a writer and that I'll write certain things and that the characters in my stories might, you know, have an affair and do things that just nice girls don't do is hard sometimes for them to understand. You know,
your novel's called How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. Do you think of yourself as having completely lost your accent? And is that something that you think is desirable?
It's funny because I'll think, well, you know, I sound very American. And then my students will say that there's a lilt to the way I talk or that I mispronounce or pronounce a word in a strange way. I don't think it's necessarily a desirable thing to lose your accent, but in this book, what I'm talking about is the other losses that come from losing your accent, from having, you know, sort of coming into America and losing the old world and the culture and the family there. Of course, you don't lose the culture and the family. That's what the girls in the book discover, that, you know, they have each other and they never lose that. But losing the accent is to me kind of a metaphor for other losses that happen when you come into America.
Julia Alvarez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Julia Alvarez is the author of the new novel, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill.